First, I'd like to extend my congratulations and joy to my fellow Newbery honorees, Audrey Columbus, Tommy DePaula, and Jennifer Holm, and to Caldecott winner Sims Tayback and honorees Molly Bang, Jerry Pinkney, Trina Shard Hyman, and David Wiesner. And an especially hearty go ahead, bruh, to one of my heroes, the winner of the first Prince Award, Mr. Walter Dean Myers, upon whose shoulders I stand. What an honor. This is the speech so many authors dream about making, and I admit that ever since the Watsons Go to Birmingham 1963 won the Newbery Honor in 1996, I've hoped that one day I'd be standing in front of the gathered throng of the ALA accepting this beautiful medal. Several firsts are taking place here tonight, some very well known, others not so well known. Among the latter is, I've done quite a bit of research on the subject, and I feel quite confident in saying that I'm the first person with dreadlocks to be presented with the Newbery. Actually, what I have are not dreads. Dreads are much more organic, much wilder. What I have are more accurately known as Nubian locks. Webster's defines Nubian as originating in or pertaining to Northeast Africa. But since I received a phone call from San Antonio, Texas, at 9:20 a.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time on January 17th, when I or my hair are referred to as Nubian, the word has had to have an entirely different spelling. From now on, for me, Nubian will no longer be spelled N-U-B-I-A-N. Now it's N-E-W, as in Newbery, B-I-A-N. So many family members and friends, old and new, are responsible for my being here today. And you can only imagine how thrilled I am that many of them are here to share this moment. If I were to start naming them, this would be a very long night indeed. But I would like to make special mention of Lynn Guest, my Aunt Joan and Uncle George, and my sister Sydney. The four of you have made everything so much easier for me. Thank you. Also to Lizzie Torres, Mikhail Wilson, Michael, Lonnie, and Ara Curtis, Lindsay Curtis, Terry Fisher, Janet Brown, Aunt Nina and Uncle June, and all of my wonderful aunts and uncles, thank you for years of kindness. And to my family members at Random House, Pearl Young, Terry Borzamato, Beverly Horowitz, Kevin Jones, Michelle Poploff, Jeanette Lundgren, Craig Verdon, and particularly Andrew Smith, Mary Raymond, and Melanie Chang. I've seen how hard all of you work, and I know I've only seen a tenth of what you do. All of the Curti, which is the plural of Curtis, thank you. And to my children, Stephen and Sydney, thank you for your contributions to both of the books. Stephen, you are directly responsible for the Watsons going as smoothly as it does. You're the best first reader an author could ask for. And Sydney, many people have told me that their favorite part of Bud Not Buddy is the song that you wrote. Mommy Says No is a classic. Thank you very much. I would also like to extend my sincerest thanks to Carolyn Brody and this year's committee for their selection of Bud Not Buddy as 2000's medal winner. I've judged a short story contest with 40 entries before, and after reading the 10th one, I thought I'd lose my mind. I'm amazed at the dedication, the time, and the strength it took for those members to complete their assignment. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm well aware of the incredible honor that has been bestowed upon me. I'd also like to thank the Newbery Committee from 1996 for honoring the Watsons Go to Birmingham 1963, and more importantly, for not holding a grudge. Let me explain. In January of 1996, there was talk that my first novel might receive some recognition from the Coretta Scott King Committee and, less likely, from the Newbery Committee as well. I had read somewhere that the committees called the authors who had won on Sunday night before an announcement was made to the general public on Monday morning. That Sunday evening in the Curtis household was horrible. The phone never rang. I even picked it up several times to make certain we had a dial tone. Finally, at 11 o'clock, I called it a night. Kay stayed up, sure that the time difference was delaying any word. The last thing I said to her as I went upstairs were, "Ah, who wants those old awards anyway?" The next morning, I headed off to the library to write. At around 9 o'clock, the phone rang, waking Kay up. It was Mary Beth Dunhouse from the Newbery Committee. I have to explain here that Kay is not a morning person. She doesn't really begin to wake up until 10-ish, so in her defense, she really wasn't sure what was going on. Ms. Dunhouse told Kay the Watsons had won a Newbery honor and asked if I was home. Kay told her, "No, he's gone to the library to write." When Ms. Dunhouse relayed that fact to the librarians, they screamed wildly. Around this time, the call waiting clicked, As I've said, Kay, who was still half asleep, said to Miss Dunhouse, "Could you hold for a minute? There's another call coming in." It was Carolyn Garns of the Coretta Scott King Committee. Kay finally woke all the way up and began chatting enthusiastically with Miss Garns. About 10 minutes into that conversation, Kay remembered the other line. When she went back, the Newbery Committee was long gone. So as you can see, I really am grateful that librarians didn't hold that against me. Not that I'd ever suspected they would. I've been involved with librarians all of my life, and I, just like Bud, have always known where to go for an ear, or for information, or for the key to the magical world of books. Libraries and librarians have always played such an important role in my life. A rite of passage occurred for me at the Flint Public Library. My siblings and I used to spend Saturday mornings at the library with my father. We'd go into the children's section while Dad, who was at that time in labor relations, went to the part of the library that was filled with books about unions and contracts. One day, Dad took David and Sydney into the youth section and told me to come with him. We walked across the hall into adult fiction, and Dad said, "You're a good enough reader to start here now." From that day on, I remember the pride and accomplishment I felt when on Saturdays we'd go to the library and David and Sydney would turn left into the world of Dr. Seuss and Harold and the Purple Crayon, and I'd turn right into the world of Langston Hughes and Mark Twain. Both of my books were written in Windsor, Ontario's public libraries. When I first started writing The Watsons Go to Birmingham, I found that once again, the children's section was the place where I was most comfortable. I'd write for 3 or 4 hours every day and was always made to feel right at home by everyone who worked there. One of the librarians in particular, Terry Fisher, took me under her wing. One of the most difficult things for a new author to do is find someone who can offer informed criticism of your work. When I finished The Watsons, I figured who better to review it than a children's librarian. Terry was the logical choice. I asked her if she would read my manuscript, and even though she had no idea if the 220 pages I handed her would be the least bit readable, she never hesitated. She said, "Of course." A couple of weeks later, I was back in the library and steeled myself to get Terry's criticism. I walked over to her desk, she looked up at me and tried to say something, but instead, she was racked with sobs. She finally said she loved my book, and I nearly broke into tears too. And now this. I don't even have to look at the table where she is, because I'll bet you dollars to donuts that she's crying all over again. But Terry, could you please stand up? Thank you once again for all of your encouragement and support. You are such a librarian. One of the proudest moments of my life happened this year, and once again the library was involved. In late January, I received a call from the Flint Public Library and was told that if a millage tax didn't pass in Flint, the same library that my father took us to on Saturdays, along with every other public library in the city, would be permanently closed. I was asked if I'd be willing to make a commercial for the millage. I said yes, but first I called my editor, Wendy Lamb, and told her what was going on. The next day, Craig Verdon, my publisher at Delacorte Press, sent a substantial check to the Friends of the Library Fund. I also called my agent, Charlotte Sheedy. The next day, Charlotte also sent a generous check to the fund. In 2 days, the fund's advertising budget had tripled. I am so proud to be involved with people like Charlotte and Wendy and Craig. The millage passed overwhelmingly. Soon after graduating from high school, much to my mother's dismay, I began working in an automobile factory in Flint called Flint Fisher Body No. 1. The factory was historic, for in 1936 and 1937, the workers took over the plant when General Motors refused to recognize the union. One of my political science professors at the University of Michigan, Flint, Dr. Neil Layton, made this period come alive. His description of the tensions and fears and tremendous danger these auto workers were exposed to seemed the stuff of high drama to me. I knew there had never been a book for young readers done about the sit-down strike, so in early 1996, I began researching the labor movement and the depression of the 1930s. By November of 96, I'd written 3 chapters of the novel, when Kay, Stephen, Sydney, and I went to Grand Rapids to my family reunion. At the reunion, the main topic of conversation was my father's father, Herman E. Curtis, who in the 1930s led a big band called Herman E. Curtis and the Dusky Devastators of the Depression. The stories of Grandpa's exploits had everyone dying with laughter. When I went back to the library in Windsor to write, I began taking notes about my grandfather. The notes turned into vignettes, and the vignettes finally overwhelmed the sit-down strike book and evolved into Bud Not Buddy. One of the questions I was constantly asked between the time that The Watsons was published and the time that Bud came out was a variation of, goodness, your first book did so well. What on earth are you going to do to top that? Early on, I made a conscious effort not to try to top that. I remember the fun I had writing The Watsons and decided that Bud would be no different. I decided I had a story to tell, that I was going to tell it the best way I could, and that I'd give no consideration whatsoever to how it would be received. I figured Wendy Lamb could worry about that. Here's another first that's taking place tonight. Many very famous people have been quoted and had their names dropped during past Newbery speeches. But Craig Verdon has confidently agreed to provide a six-figure advance and a two-book deal, or one of the typically high-salaried, glamorous jobs in the world of New York publishing, to anyone who can conclusively prove that the person I'm about to quote has ever been cited in a Newbery speech before, Mr. Sylvester Stewart. No need to rummage through old copies of the Horn Book. Mr. Verdon's money is safe. Sylvester Stewart is better known as Sly from Sly and the Family Stone. Sly said, looking at the devil, grinning at his guns. Fingers started shaking. I begin to run. Bullets start chasing. I begin to stop. We begin to wrestle. I was on the top. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. The pertinent line is the last one. I want to thank you for letting me be myself again. I'm not exactly sure what Sly had in mind when he wrote about that, but it rings of the highest truth to me tonight. I really do have the need to tell several people thank you for letting me be myself, starting right at home. To my mother and father, Herman E. Curtis Jr. and Leslie Lewis Curtis, thank you for letting me be myself. It wasn't until I had children of my own that I truly understood my parents. It wasn't until I, too, worried about what the world had in store for my young black children that I appreciated my mother's protectiveness. And protective she was. Mama was convinced that our neighborhood in Flint was the poison capital of North America. As such, we were not allowed to go trick-or-treating. Mama had it on the highest authority that every apple given out at Halloween has a razor blade in it, that every Hershey bar had been dusted with enough rat poison to bring down an elephant, that each nut chew was chock full of ground-up glass from a six-pack of Faygo Red Pop. This is not to say that we didn't go trick-or-treating, just that we didn't go out to go trick-or-treating. So we wouldn't feel totally left out of the festivities, Mama developed a brilliant plan. What the Curtis children would do is gather in a whiny, pouting group, go to a closed bedroom door in the house, yell trick-or-treat, and lo and behold, Mama would open the door and drop some candy in our bag. We'd then wait while she moved to the next bedroom, and the sad little scene played itself out again. By the time we reached the bathroom door, I've got to tell you, the thrill was gone, and all whining about going trick-or-treating ceased. In addition to being protective, my mother and father have always been supportive and encouraging. I remember writing an article for a school paper in the sixth grade. I brought it home to do the final touches, and when I was done, I gave it to Mama. After reading my work, she said, "Oh, dear, I wish you'd left this at school. Your teacher's going to think it was written by an adult." I've had a starred box review in Publishers Weekly and glowing reviews from the New York Times, but neither of them has meant as much to me as those words from my mother. Mama, thank you for letting me be myself. Wendy Lamb, who is blessed with the perfect name for children's literature, thank you for letting me be myself. I never understood or appreciated how much a book is a collaboration between an author and an editor until Wendy took both of my books in hand and improved them immensely. I've worked in an automobile factory for 13 years. I've hauled garbage. I've mowed lawns. I've worked for the census. I've been a maintenance man. I've unloaded trucks and spent hours sorting through and recycling paper. But I think I'd rather go back to any one of those jobs than be an editor. I can't imagine a more difficult profession. Not only is a good editor technically on top of what she is doing, she also must be able to deal with a writer, a person who can range from frighteningly insecure to unbelievably cocky, often in the same conversation. After seeing how hard she worked on my books, I asked Wendy why the editor wasn't at least given an acknowledgement on the copyright page. She told me that the editor's job was to be invisible, merely another set of eyes for the author, and Wendy's touch has been invisible. After each of my books has been published, I think to myself, Why is Wendy Lam making that big, cushy, typically high New York publishing house salary? It doesn't seem to me like she did very much on this book. Then I'd make the mistake of reading through our correspondences, or worse, reading the actual first draft of the book. I'd end up saying things such as, "Wait a minute, I could swear I was the one who thought of doing it that way," or, "Ooh, that's right, Wendy did say it would make more sense if Buphead said," or, "Yikes, she's right again. Booger is mentioned a couple of times too many on this page." I remember going to Wendy's office for the first time and being absolutely crushed. I screamed, "Wendy, I thought I was the only one." I was shocked to see that she actually worked on other people's books. Though I didn't want to believe it, the evidence was irrefutable. On her desk was a well-thumbed-through Graham Salisbury manuscript, and in a pile that nearly reached the ceiling was a stack of 14 or 15 novels. I rushed over to see whose they were and can still remember the searing pain in my heart as I cried out, "Oh, Wendy, not Gary Paulson. Tell me it's anyone but Gary Paulson." I'd always pictured Wendy sitting around her office, napping or biting her fingernails or playing solitaire while she waited for me to send her my latest rewrite. But I guess the old saying is true. The author's always the last one to know. Wendy Lam, thank you for pulling the Watsons Go to Birmingham 1963 out of a pile of nearly 400 other manuscripts entered in your contest, the Delacorte Press Prize for a first young adult novel. And thank you for letting me be myself. Finally, Cassandra Ann Yasmin Sukram Curtis, KB Baby, thank you for letting me be myself. In 1993, Kay took a tremendous leap of faith and said to me, "Look, I know you hate your job, and I don't think you're doing everything you can with your life. I've read some of the things you've written, and I bet you could be a writer. So why don't you take a year off work and see if you could write a book?" Kay got me writing and is probably the person most responsible for me standing here tonight. That's an easy story to tell, but it leaves a lot of the gory details out. And believe me, there are gory details when you take a year off to write a book. Perhaps the biggest gory detail is fear. There was the fear that the year would be wasted, the fear that I wouldn't be able to produce anything worthwhile, and the all-encompassing fear when I realized I was being given a chance to make no excuses. There was also the fear of admitting to people that I was going to try to make a career as a writer. I knew the looks this would draw from friends and family would be somewhat akin to the way they'd look if I'd announced I was quitting my job to either be a brain surgeon or a ballerina. But Kay even had me covered there. When money would allow, we would make our one family trip a year to Toronto to attend the Caribbean festival known as Carabana. In 1993, we ended up at a party with a group of five or six other couples. My worst nightmare developed right in front of my eyes. Everybody began taking turns telling what they did for a living. Before I could excuse myself and run to the bathroom to hide, all eyes turned to me. I hung my head and whispered, "I'm a writer." I don't know which was worse, the embarrassing silence that followed my announcement or the snicker that someone couldn't contain. All the women in the group looked sympathetically at Kay. Kay never missed a beat. She said, "That's right, he's a writer and a very good one, and one day all of you are going to know who he is." The women in the group still looked at Kay with sympathy, but now it was sympathy colored with a touch of pity. In 1993, an essay I'd written and an early draft of The Watsons Go to Birmingham won the Avery and Jules Hopwood Awards at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. While I waited on stage to accept my prizes, Kay sat next to the mother of another winner. I don't know what their conversation was, but afterwards, the woman came up to me and said, "You know, with a wife like that, you don't have any choice but to be a success as a writer." I didn't understand what the woman meant at the time, but now I do. It's much like Bud Caldwell's mom told him, with the right love and care and hope, miraculous things can happen. A confused, lost bud can blossom into a beautiful flower, or an unhappy, unfulfilled factory worker can bloom into an author who realizes his dream, can become someone who doesn't have to imagine what it feels like to stand before a gathered throng of the ALA and accept this beautiful medal. Kay, thank you for providing that love and care and hope. Thank you for letting me be myself. In January of 2000, there was talk once again that my novel might receive some consideration from both the Coretta Scott King Committee and the Newbery Committee. This speculation does not make for an easy Sunday night's rest. On the morning of Monday, January 17th, Kay took our daughter Sydney to school, leaving me to field any calls that came in. 9 o'clock came and went. At about 9:10, I repeated my lines from 4 years earlier. Ah, who wants those old awards anyway? At 9:16, the King Committee called, and at 9:32, the Newbery Committee called. When Kay came home around 10 o'clock, I'd had plenty of time to compose myself. She opened the door, found me sitting on the couch reading, and said, "You didn't hear anything?" I said, "Well, just as a hypothetical, let's say I won the honors from both committees again. Would that mean I could be excused from doing all housework for the next year?" Kay said, "Huh, you'd have to win the gold from both of them before that would happen." After we hugged and cheered and cried, Kay said, "You know I was only kidding about the housework, don't you?" Thank you, Kay, for letting me be myself. Bud Caldwell coped with life by developing a set of rules and things to have a funner life and make a better liar of yourself. Christopher Curtis has coped with the attention and exhilaration of winning the Newbery and Coretta Scott King Awards by developing a set of rules and things for keeping your ego in check and your feet firmly planted on the ground. Rules and things number 541. Don't worry about getting a big head. Friends, family, and total strangers will see to it that there's no way in the world you will be allowed to become too full of yourself. Two examples. Time magazine started its article about me by stating that I'm 6'2" and weigh 240 pounds. When I was interviewed by Essence magazine, the reporter told me he'd seen those statistics and stated, "I don't know why they had to put that in there. I'm kind of tall and husky myself. They didn't have to tell everyone that stuff. I mean, the brother can't help it if he's got tall genes in his family. The brother can't help it if he likes a sandwich every now and then." Ouch. The other example took place in New York City in March. Melanie Chang, my publicist at Random House, and I were walking through the lobby of the DoubleTree Suites in Times Square when a woman spotted me and came up to us very excitedly and said, "Oh my God, I don't believe it. Aren't you the guy who wrote that book?" I smiled humbly and said, "Yeah, that's me." Melanie asked the woman if she was in New York to attend the National Council of Teachers of English conference. The woman replied, "No, I'm here on vacation, and I'd heard about your book and picked it up for the flight. I love it." "Thank you," I replied even more humbly. The woman said, "I've got my copy right upstairs. Is there any way I can get you to sign it?" Melanie told her, "We're going to lunch here in the hotel. We'll be here for the next hour or so." The woman beamed and said, "Thank you so much. I'll be right back." I don't know which one of us was more pleased, if it was Melanie because the Random House publicity machine was so potent that here was a non-teacher, non-librarian who had heard of her author, or if it was I because I'd been recognized in the heart of New York City. I mean, it's one thing to be recognized in downtown Flint, Michigan, but it's a whole nother world to have a stranger know you in the Big Apple. Melanie and I went to the restaurant and sat at a table so our fan could easily spot us. A few minutes later, the woman came squealing and gushing to our table and handed me her book. It was Monster by my hero, Walter Dean Myers. Once again, thank you, thank you, thank you to the Newbery Committee for giving me the freedom to be myself. Thank you so much to the many librarians and teachers who, through their recognition, also encouraged me to be myself and who have permitted three voices from Flint, Michigan, Kenny Watson, Bud Caldwell, and Christopher Curtis to be heard across this land.